Hey everybody, Jason here. One last minute change to this episode. I'm too lazy to go back and change it, but I mentioned an episode that's supposed to be coming out the 31st of December. That's actually going to come out on the 3rd of January. So there will still be a special New Year's present to everybody coming out on Saturday. So watch for that. But after Saturday's episode, the next episode from me is going to be the 3rd of January, which is next Wednesday. Okay, enjoy the show.
Pour yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings. Full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on. Contest and of course, you know it's all about games. That's a slow down. Let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast with the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today is mainly just going to be a quick call-in show. I know now during the holiday season, people have more time off. A lot of us end up being really busy during this time of year, though, and have less time to listen or to record podcasts than we normally would. I know me personally, right now I'm super busy. So I want to just throw one thing out there. You know, a missed opportunity this year has been identifying role-playing games for the different movies that have been discussed on this show. We did all those Albert Pune films. And then we've done the movie night, which is now moving over to Spencer's show over at Keep Off the Borderlands. And all those movies, you know, what game would you use to run those movies if you're going to run it? I think that's an interesting question. And so I'm going to go back through and try to identify that for everybody. And you're not going to get that this show, but I am putting out a show on Sunday, December 31st. So on the 31 December show, the last show of the year, I will do a year wrap-up and say what RPG system I would use for each of the movies that the major movies I've talked about this year. So the Albert Pune movies and the movie night movies. I'm not going to do things I've talked about incidentally or other things. But so you have that to look forward to. Aside from that, not really any gaming happening for me lately due to the busyness. But hopefully that'll slow down next year, and in January I'll get back to the table and get some gaming done. So without further ado, I am going to just go to the callers. First up is Daniel of the Bandit's Keep Media Empire.
Hey Jason, Daniel from Bandit's Keep calling in. I'm just starting to listen to the call-in show. Awesome to hear from new callers. But, you know, you addressed the point that James made about the being played at the table, which I think is, of course, a very good point. But kind of what slipped into the beginning, which I think a lot of people might not have noticed, or you could kind of breeze past us, I guess, is that the idea that the GM might be tricking you or whatever. And I think that's kind of what MW was talking about, not to put words in MW's mouth, but the idea that, like, he's telling his player he can do something and they're not trusting. At least that's the way I see it. If I had a player not do something that I said, oh, you can do it in this circumstance, I would assume that the reason why was because they thought it was going to be, as Kerr loves to call it, a screw job. You know, like, oh, sure, pick up the sword, cleric. And then when they pick it up, lightning strikes you from your deity. You're no longer a cleric. Ha ha ha. And I don't know. I feel like these, like, Dr. Evil stroking a cat DMs aren't really something that exists, or maybe they are. Maybe they existed in the past. Maybe that's the cruelty of playing when you're a teenager or in college. These are stories I hear from people. I didn't play when I was an older teenager, nor when I was in college. So I wouldn't for the life of me ever tell a player as a DM that their character could do something and then basically turn it around on them. Unless I said, cleric, you can pick up that sword, but you know it's against your clerical order and there will be, you know, penance to be paid or something like that. I would never just let them do it or, you know, tell them they should do it. And I think that's probably also on the other end. So the players, yes, you know, don't be rude. The DM does put whatever work in and this and that. That's all super important. But I think the other part's also important as DMs. If you can't establish a trust at your table, then the players aren't going to want to do that. And this is something we've talked about. Now I'm rambling, but this is something we talked about before. We talked about the idea of like, oh, when they're in town, the NPCs all steal from them and everybody's a jerk. This creates a hostile environment at the table that the players can't trust you and trust the world. And that's kind of why that happens, I think. So for me, I mean, I'm not advocating for a, you know, kinder, gentler D&D, but at the same time, I think that we need to put forth on our table like the difference between the world and us, right? I am the DM outside the game meta telling you this is what will happen and this, you know, this is what you can do and this will be the consequence. And by laying that on the table fairly, I think you will get players that are more than willing to take the sacrifice of, let's say, picking up the sword and having to do the penance in order to survive. So anyways, that's just my thoughts on that call, which was a really great call. So, but it just really stuck to me because I feel like that's something that just gets glossed over, this idea of trust at the table. And if the DM's telling you something, like there might be a chance they're actually trying to set you up. That just feels very off to me anyways, at least the way that I play D&D.
Hey, Daniel, thank you so much for that call. You're right. I was in a rush to get that episode out. I've been quite under the time crunch in 2023, and it's just going to get worse in 2024. We have lots of things happening outside the gaming sphere in real life with work and with home and family stuff, and I need to draw back. That's one of the reasons, you know, last episode for the Conan Christmas, I've announced the movie night, the monthly movie night where everybody watches the movie and calls in their thoughts on the movie, is now going to be over at Keep Off the Borderland, Spencer's podcast. And the, of course, everybody, if you missed that episode or haven't listened yet, those links are in the show notes. If you want to call thoughts in, a late thought about Conan, thoughts about the Conan show, or you want to call in an entry for the January 2024 movie, Time Bandits, call it over to Spencer. But, you know, that relieving myself in the movie nights, one of the things I'm going to be doing in 2024 to try to better manage my time, and hopefully better managing my time will help me not rush through these calls and not answer all the important points like you just brought up there. So that'll also probably look like, you know, maybe one episode a week for me, cutting back on the number of episodes I put out. So we'll see how that looks. But thank you for the call, and thank you for those important points. I think there's a balancing act there. I think the players need to see that the GM isn't screwing them, but I do think it's important for there to be a verisimilitude, I can't say that word, the world to feel real, depending on the game you're playing. So I don't know that having, you know, townspeople try to steal from the characters is a bad thing. I don't know that getting braced by tax collectors or having a thief try to pickpocket them is a bad thing in the game. I do think if you do it all the time, if your henchmen that you hire always screw over the players, then yeah, that's adversarial and that's a problem. But if it happens once, just one time during a campaign, and the GM tells the players, listen, I'm not trying to teach you a lesson, this just happened to be a bad egg that you guys came across, hopefully the players can accept that and move forward. I know that's tough because it's a game and people get butthurt about things, but I think there should be room in the game for you to get a plant in your henchman, that maybe the bad guy plants a henchman with you that's spying on you or something like that. I think that needs to be a possibility in the game, but it's got to be a card the GM plays pretty rarely. I think if you're in a big city, you know, then attempts to pickpocket you and things probably need to happen. But probably not all the time. You know, again, it's a balancing act, right? But no, great call. Thank you for that. And let's go on to your next call.
Hey, Jason. Daniel from Bandits Keep calling in about the Night Stalker. Of course, we've exchanged a little bit on Discord, but I ended up watching Night Stalker and Night Strangler. And then I'm mostly done with listening to the episode. But I wanted to call in again because I was thinking a similar thing to what you guys are talking about. When you're talking about the monster of the week and why is it everywhere he goes, he runs into a monster. Well, I'm reading James Bond, like an Ian Fleming James Bond, but Thunderball at that. And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking to myself, wow, like, everywhere Bond goes, he runs into exactly the right person, right? That's the criminal or whatever. It's like, what's the chances of that? But that is, as Kara said, that's the suspension of disbelief, right? There wouldn't be a story if Bond didn't run into the criminals everywhere he went. There wouldn't be a story if Kolchak didn't. And this actually plays into horror in general. Like, when you think about Call of Cthulhu, right? Like, if you were to actually play a long campaign in Call of Cthulhu, not one of these, like, pre-written ones that has this, like, overarching plot, but you just kind of did it yourself, like homebrew, and then, like, I don't know, every once in a while there'd be a real mythos thing. The rest of the time, it's just nothing. I think that would actually not be interesting. I think even though it's, you know, the Lovecraft stories and stuff are written as in, like, this is a one-time in somebody's life thing. If you're going to play a campaign, the characters just keep running into that stuff. It's just the way it is. And that's part of it, right? That's part of the fun of it. As I think the care, maybe Jason, you know, you can't introduce a new detective every week. That'd be boring for a lot of people when you're watching a TV show. And it actually, weirdly, I'm cutting now, this is really rambling, but I had called into Decahedron a while back. They're talking about the Foundation series. And I think that's one thing that you write. So you guys are talking about what would be good in a book versus whatever. And like Foundation, they completely changed the idea of it. And they had to, because if you read that first book, there's no real main characters. It's like a bunch of little vignettes. And that's not a TV show, right? People want to see returning characters. They want to see their hero progress and change. So I think that, yeah, there's different formats for different things. And all in all, I really enjoyed both movies. I thought they were both really good. It's funny how the plots of them are very similar, even down to the, all right, give me 30 minutes before you call the police at the end. When he said that in the second movie, I was like, that's literally the exact same thing. Oh, man, so good. Excellent topic, fun movie. Thanks again, guys. Talk to you soon.
Hey, Daniel, thank you for that. So, of course, he's talking about the Night Stalker and the Night Strangler TV movies that came before the Kolchak, the Night Stalker TV show. The Night Strangler is a pretty fun movie. It's a good movie taken of itself, but if you watch it after you've seen the original, you can see where it kind of borrows plot points from the original, from Night Strangler. I'm sorry, from the Night Stalker. And it's, you know, the Night Strangler is stronger in some aspects, but ultimately the Night Stalker is the better movie. But The Night Strangler is a neat movie. Like I said, we have the Seattle Underground there. We have a really interesting villain there. It's pretty good. It really is. I enjoy both. I've got both on DVD. I don't know if I bought them on Blu-ray or not. I have to look. And I've got the Kolchak series, of course, also on home media, because you can't trust streaming these days. But that's enough tinfoil hat stuff for me. Yeah, go out and check it out, folks. There's tons of RPG material. There's RPG gold in their TV movies and TV episodes. Let's go on to one last call. Well, one last call at the time I'm answering this call from Daniel.
Hey, Jason. Daniel calling in about MW's call. You know, it's interesting, and maybe I'm, I don't know, being a little contentious here. We'll see. I think that his answer is almost an admission that there is a problem. Because, right, they made D&D. They made original Dungeons & Dragons. And yes, there is that upkeep, and it's actually 1% of your total experience points, but there's not taxes, there's not training, there's none of this. And I think they added that for the same reason that Gygax added a lot of things to the game, which is they saw a problem. They were like, oh man, hold on, that's not enough. And if people aren't building castles or researching spells, they've got a lot of money. What can we do? So then he started making stuff up, which is basically all AD&D is. Right? Just like every edition of D&D is just a bunch of new rules added on to try to, I don't know, fix what might be perceived as problems. So I don't think, oh, well, you just charge them for training is the answer to this too much gold. I think that's kind of, you just are putting a Band-Aid on an issue, if it's an issue at all. Now, I don't find it to be an issue personally. I like that the characters basically have tons of gold because I give them things to spend it on. They buy ships, they start armies, they have castles. I mean, they've got stuff to do with the gold. You don't need to tax them. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to play a game where I'm worried about paying income tax. That's just not fun for me. And yeah, so that's one reason why I think that when you look at the resurgence of the old games, I would say, and I'm making a bold statement here with no actual evidence, I think that much of the OSR, or the people that go back to playing the old games, they're playing the basic editions for that reason. They don't want all that complication. That just seems silly. To me, it would be easier to do what BJ said, or anybody else, which is give them experience points per silver and then just cut down the amount of treasure if you don't have players that want to invest in the world. You know, I mean, I think the idea of being like, all right, well, we're still going to give you, you know, all this gold, and then I'm just going to take it from you because, haha, taxes. Do you think that wild adventurers with all kinds of power are going to want to pay taxes? Are you kidding me? It just feels ridiculous. So I think, and I mean, I'm sure we'll hear back from people that totally disagree with me because I know AD&D is very popular, but that does not seem fun at all. And I will say that when we were kids, we did do training. I gave everybody 100, or I already talked about this before. I never downrated anybody. I think that's very lame, first of all, and I've said that before. But we did pay for training. But the other thing is our characters spent extravagantly. They had tons of money. They bought fur capes and fancy horses and, you know, gold chains. You know, Mr. T was really popular when I was a kid. But, you know, that's what we did. And that's all you need to do in the world. You don't need to take the money from the players. I just personally don't like that idea. But again, that's just me. I'm sure I am I'm not unique, but I'm sure I'm maybe not the majority there, but we'll find out, I guess, with other calls. I will, of course, look out for his episode and listen to the other prongs. Oh, by the way, I think his first prong is 100% correct, which is adventure is adventure to adventure, right? Even if they have gold, they're going to adventure because they want to. That's the idea. And if you can't find a reason for your character to adventure, then yeah, you retire him and you start a new character. That's easy.
So I'm happy that I helped Daniel remind himself how much he loved Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. I kid, Daniel will tell you, and I know I'm kind of putting words in his mouth, but I'm really not. The first edition AD&D DMG by Guy Gax is one of Daniel's favorite role-playing books. I'm comfortable saying that. It's one of the last books he would probably get rid of because it's fun to read and there's so much inspiration in there. But I don't see Daniel ever running or trying. Let's not get in the rules as written by the book debate, but I don't see Daniel ever running AD&D using all the rules in the book. Let me say that. And that's okay. There's different strokes, different folks. We're in the holiday seasons. No reason to argue about this stuff. I understand where you're coming from, Daniel. I think actually that if you just do the 100 gold pieces by level per month, as AD&D DMG says, that handles living expenses. And I think you could wrap taxes up and all that stuff in there. I think at lower levels, it's fine counting gold pieces and doing all that stuff. But once you get higher levels, then I think that's fine. I like training costs. I like all that kind of thing. It's not about punishing the players. It's about encouraging them to go out and get gold, right? But, I mean, it just depends what kind of game you want to play. I mean, that's the kind of game I see D&D is. If I want to play a different kind of fantasy game, then maybe I'll run Barbarians Lemuria, right? Which is a little bit different setup. Or maybe I'll run a different kind of game. So I think my perspective is a little different because I am not as big into fantasy games as I am into other genres. So, you know, we talk a ton about Dungeons and Dragons on here, and I end up defending Gygax and defending TSR a ton on this show. But ultimately, if I had to pick AD&D, we talked about this before. AD&D would be have to be my favorite role-playing game, probably because there's so much to talk about, and I talk about it more than anything else, and we discuss it more than anything else. But if you ask what game do I want to play, AD&D or any Dungeons & Dragons, let's say that, probably any Dungeons & Dragons game might not make my top five. It doesn't make my top three games that, if you ask me what campaign would I love to be in right now, AD&D is not in my top three. No Dungeons & Dragons is in my top three. So it's funny that it's the main topic on my show so often. We'll see what that looks like in 2024. But thank you for that call. I really appreciate it. Also, the other show that Daniel was referring to in that call, of course, was MW Lewis's The Worlds of M.W. Lewis, where he's going to have a bunch of episodes coming out at the end of this year talking about different topics, including gold. And he's already put one out about post-apocalyptic. So go check that out. I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Hey, Mr. Jason, it's Johnny. You messed up by encouraging me to call back. Now I'm going to do this again. I've been listening to talking about the weapons, the clerics not being able, having restricted weapons, wizards and all that, magic users, as it were. And it occurs to me that if it's for game balance, if it's for the gaming thing and it's not for some kind of, I hate this word, flavor, so overused, but you could just drop the die of damage specifically for that class. So when you wouldn't have to keep track of a bunch of different damages for weapons, but for magic users, you just look, you can use a longsword, but you're only going to do D4. That's the damage you're going to do. And as an abstraction, it works. You've learned how to use it. You're quote unquote proficient in it, but you're not really delivering the same kind of hits. You're not moving the ways that wear people down, that take away their hit points, into the point where you're actually doing physical damage. 4 hit points can kill a lot of people. So that works. It will work for clerics as well. You just drop them down to D6. You can use a two-handed sword. You're going to do D6 damage. And that way they can have their image. They can have their character thing. They can pick up these weapons. Now, if they, God forbid, one, that would be, they get penalties. So you solve the problem right there with that. And since it's character specific, again, you don't have to keep track of a bunch of them. I think that's it. I haven't thought that through real deeply. People might find a problem with it. But if we're just talking about game balance, there's no reason that I can think of right now to not just do it that way. Thank you. I'll talk to you later. I didn't mean that as a threat. Bye.
Thank you for calling back. I'm glad I didn't scare you away. Always welcome. That's an interesting idea, and it's definitely been used in games before. The Black Hack jumps to mind, but I'm sure that wasn't the first one where the idea of class-specific damage dice was used. And in fact, it's something that Eric over at the Omega 3D Chicken Coop has recommended for use with D&D-style games, and we're going to discuss that more this coming Saturday on our end-of-the-year special Rule Cyclopedia Extravaganza. So that comes out on Saturday. I hope everybody tunes in on that, the 30th of December, another holidays present that we're giving to you listeners. But thank you for that call. Really appreciate it. The success of that mechanic, the idea of class damage dice, really depends on your table. If your table likes to have long lists of pole arms and weapons really differentiated in what they do, and different weapons do better against certain armor classes and things like that, then it's not going to work. I mean, it could work. You could use all the other rules, like in AD&D, except the damage, but it could still get the bonuses against different kinds of armor types and do all that. You could still do all that, I guess. But generally, it works, I think, more for more simplistic games. But, I mean, it is valid, and there are lots of games that use it. And I've been in a long-running Black Hat campaign that used it that, it didn't break the game at all. So thank you so much for that call. I look forward to hearing more calls in the future.
Hey, Jason, did you know that you'd be getting this much discussion out of a quick statement about the gold standard and the post-apocalyptic setting of D&D? It's certainly been interesting to follow. I appreciate what W.M. Lewis was saying about the apocalypse and going back to what the word actually means. I mean, the book of Revelation it's called Revelation because that's what it is, Revelation, that's the word apocalypse. But because of the content of that revelation and, the scare of the 50s and everything, yes, it means something more. But, I'm with Carl, I'm with Joe about the Black Death being an apocalypse. It did alter society to such a great extent. The Black Death devastated the population of Europe. Landlords still needed the work done, but there was a huge labor shortage. The laborers could negotiate and move about and get much better wages and conditions. All of this led to the Renaissance and completely changed the history of Europe and the history of the world. We no longer have feudalism, and, you know, we completely changed the trajectory of history after that. Yes, it didn't completely wipe out humanity or anything like that, but it was very devastating, and it did lead to major changes, for sure. Take care.
Hey, Merk, I appreciate the call. And, you know, the problem is the way the arguments get framed, and I don't always frame discussions very well. I said arguments, but I don't always frame discussions as well as I should. So while you guys are all probably right in a strict definition sense, that doesn't help us with gaming, right? What we're looking for is for post-apocalyptic gaming. Is D&D a post-apocalyptic game? You have a points of light kind of thing. You have ancient technologies that people find and have to research to figure out how they work. Lost civilizations that they find the ruins of and plumb for new and exciting items, magical artifacts maybe. You know, that's kind of what we're discussing here, right? In Rome falling and the Black Plague, they don't give us any of that. You know, they don't give us Gamma World. So when we say post-apocalyptic gaming, nobody thinks of Dark Age Europe, but people think of Gamma World, Mutant Crawl Classics, you know, Morrow Project. They think of those kind of games. Rifts, maybe. So what's useful for a post-apocalyptic role-playing game? So what's useful in the definition of a post-apocalyptic role-playing game? If you say after the Black Death, is that useful for the definition of a post-apocalyptic role-playing game? I don't think so. And that's an issue with fantasy worlds in general. You know, because I think part of the post-apocalyptic thing, and this could be twisted to fit the Black Death, but is the idea that is society even going to recover? You know, you should have survival aspects. You should have potentially marauders, probably a breakdown in universal law or general law. You should have the worry that society, if society is ever going to recover again, you should have, you know, the scarcity resources. And yeah, all that you could say applies to Black Death. But if I say post-apocalyptic role-playing game, do you think Black Death or do you think Gamma World? And ultimately, that's kind of where I was going for. And that's why I get frustrated with these discussions. Because, yes, is Tolkien's world post-apocalyptic? Sure. If I say post-apocalyptic role-playing game, do you think The One Ring? See what I mean? You know, there's a long-running discussion over at the RPG Pub internet forum. Although it might have started after we started talking about it, actually. But they're talking about what makes a fantasy world feel post-apocalyptic. And some of the things are things like I mentioned, you know, scarcities and do you know if the world's going to recover, things like that. But the other things, important points brought up in that thread are things like, is magic reliable? Is magic disappearing? You know, should we be importing the Dungeon Crawl Classics failure table into our D&D game? Are magic items unreliable? Are magic swords slowly losing their minds, intelligent swords, or are they slowly fading away and dying? So is your intelligent swords or artifacts reaching out to the characters asking you to try to find a way to save them? You know, there's all kinds of, you know, are your fantastical creatures being born misgotten or losing their magic? You know, things like that. That I think is a really interesting thing you could do to make your fantasy world feel post-apocalyptic. Because it's a lot harder to make a fantasy world feel post-apocalyptic than it is if you start off with the baseline of after the Third World War, right? I don't know. It is an interesting topic. I don't try to control topics. I don't try to control the direction of callers unless they're inappropriate. But I'll admit, having gotten maybe a little frustrated with some of the calls just because I'm not so worried about real world definitions of what is an apocalypse and, you know, is the Black Death an apocalypse compared to what the conquistadors did over in Central America, right? Those are interesting discussions. They're not necessarily discussions that I'm interested in having on this podcast. But that doesn't make them any less interesting or any less useful discussions. But ultimately, in the end, I was looking at kind of what that thread that I have in the show notes at RPG Pub talks about. You know, how do we define post-apocalyptic for gaming, so we know when we bill a game as post-apocalyptic, how's it going to feel? You know, and that's kind of where I was going with that. And ultimately, it just sounds like I'm not as interested in simulating the real world as some other people are in the gaming sphere, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, give me Palladium Books' After the Bomb with mutated animals any day over a gritty Walking Dead survival thing where you've got zombies as environmental dangers and the party dynamics, or you're worried about somebody stealing your mate. You know, that I have no desire to role play in that world, to be honest with you. Thank you for all the calls. I really appreciate it. Thank you to everybody for all your calls this year, for tuning in this year. I've got a couple more shows that are still coming out, but I hope everybody's doing well. I want to thank TJ for the wonderful music, Ray Otis for the coffee cup clip art, and until Saturday, when Eric from the Omega 3D Chicken Coop joins me to talk about the Rule Cyclopedia, be excellent to each other. Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Maybe it's your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if the fiddle's even dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some more, bring on the gore. Well, your butcher is a dustman and your moiler's by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world's gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.